On February 24th, Russia invaded the country of Ukraine in an unexpected escalation of a conflict that began in 2014. It is the largest conventional military attack in Europe since World War II. According to an influential analysis of Russia's aggression towards Ukraine, this is all down to NATO's overreach in the region, and Russia is simply defending itself from being encircled by Western power. But pay closer attention to what Putin is actually saying, and a very different explanation emerges. Putin believes it's his destiny to restore Russia to its former glory days. So how should we interpret the actions of states like Russia? Are they merely driven by power and security concerns, like the realist school of thought claims? Or are the beliefs and worldviews of political leaders like Putin, as well as the national identities of people like those of Ukraine, the real driving force of events? Is necessity and structural issues the motor of history, or is it contingency and uncertainty at the steering wheel? Welcome to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I welcome to the podcast Stathis Kalivas. He is the Gladstone Professor of Government at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of All Souls College. He is a political scientist who has written extensively on civil wars, ethnicity, and political violence, and is the author of, among other books, The Logic of Violence in Civil War. Our conversation was based on an article Kalivas wrote for the Institute of Art and Ideas entitled How We Got Putin So Wrong. Stathis Kalivas, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'd like to talk to you today about making sense of Putin, essentially, and the different frameworks that are available for making sense of what's happening in Ukraine. And one of the main narratives that you've written about and criticized is that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is to be understood somehow as being ultimately due to NATO's encircling of Russia. So there are some deeper causes here that have to do with how the West has been behaving towards Russia. And Russia is just reacting to that in a way that any country would. It's just trying to protect its national interest and its national security. Can you tell us a little bit about this purported explanation and where does it originate?
Well, let us start from the beginning, perhaps. One of the biggest difficulties with social science is that what we observe is almost never enough to adjudicate between competing explanations. It's what we call the problem of observational equivalence. So here we have a very stark event, which is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the question is, what explains it? And we're trying to find the best way to adjudicate between different kinds of theoretical frames that would best make sense of it. And it's very difficult because they all have elements that contribute to an explanation. So the first and perhaps most controversial kind of argument that has been put forth by a number of international relations scholars, primarily in the United States, is the idea that Russia was, in a sense, rationally reacting to NATO overreach. Ukraine is seen as a buffer state, vital for Russia's defense and interests. And allowing that buffer state to go over to NATO would be a very big strategic blow that Russia was never going to accept. And so the invasion is the unsurprising, the expected result of that overreach. There are a number of problems with this theory. Doesn't really tell us much about timing. Why now? Why not 6 years ago? So you need to add additional layers of explanation to make it work. Also doesn't tell us why an invasion as opposed to other forms of action that might have been more effective in preventing the Ukraine from going over, and also doesn't give any agency to Ukraine itself. It is as if this is a game between the United States or the West, however one wants to define it, and Russia, without really any other actor doing anything. And we also don't have the capacity to really get into Putin's head and sort of interpret, you know, what is the thought process. Finally, we have a problem with the way in which Putin justifies what he does, which often is not consistent just with a NATO kind of theory. And it's not clear also whether the facts themselves support this type of explanation, because it's not clear that NATO was about to accept Ukrainian membership. In fact, NATO had been very adverse to this idea, and you could argue that the Ukrainians pressed more for it after the 2014 invasion of the Crimea and annexation of the Crimea, and also the war on the eastern frontier. So we have a lot of different facts that make an explanation purely based on the realist explanation kind of problematic, without necessarily removing any logic of it. It has a core that needs to be taken seriously, but at the same time, certainly it's clearly not enough.
So you mentioned that this is part of the so-called realist interpretation of sort of international relations, and it's a kind of theoretical framework that international relations scholars use to explain the behavior of states and of big events in geopolitics, especially events to do with conflict. Can you tell us a little bit more about what are the fundamental tenets, as it were, of this realist theory? What are the assumptions, and what are the kind of main explanatory tools that they put in use?
In its foundation, it's a very sort of simple theory. The world is anarchical. There is no central authority. And therefore, it's sort of law of the jungle, in which if you want to protect yourself, you have to be very aggressive about making sure no one else gets an advantage over you. One implication is the theory of balancing. If one power becomes very powerful, all the other powers balance out against this initial one. And if there is no balance, you basically are in a world of constant conflict until you have some sort of balancing out, or until you have a hegemon that controls the entire globe, which realist scholars do not anticipate happening anytime soon. So it's a very simple theory about a Darwinian world in which, you know, the strong try to keep their advantage by preventing their power from eroding from competition. That's pretty much what it is.
And you mentioned earlier in your response as well, this this term that comes across as a rational actor, and people who sort of adopt this theory are trying to explain Russia as a rational actor. Now, I also know that there are a lot of people around who think, oh, you know, Putin has just gone crazy, he's lost touch with reality, and all sorts of kind of psychologizing explanations of why he's doing what he's doing. But in this case, rational actor means something quite different, doesn't it? It's sort of like a technical term. So what do these theorists mean when they say Putin is a rational actor, or Russia is behaving like a rational actor? What exactly do they suggest?
So rationality, as understood in the context of various paradigms, is fundamentally a means-end rationality, is that you've got your preferences, and those are outside the rational framework. And then you think about how to maximize the likelihood that you will get your best preference out of an interaction with somebody else. And this is where rationality comes in. You are going to follow the course of action that best maximizes your chance of getting the outcome you want. Now, rationality is perfectly consistent with what is known as suboptimal outcomes, because the interaction between two equally rational actors may lead to an outcome under some conditions that is not the best for either of them, for example. So one shouldn't assume that rationality equals the best outcome. or that rationality equals rational preferences. If you have crazy preferences, you can be rational in trying to make sure, you know, follow the best way to make your preferences come out.
Mm-hmm. So it just means that somehow the people making the decisions are acting in how they see as kind of rational, in the sense of trying to preserve the self-interest of their state and to protect their state.
And this is where there is another theory of international relations often comes in, which is constructivism, which tries to make sense, number one, of how actors understand, how states understand what their goals and preferences are. The preferences are not given. They do not exist outside the state or, you know, a particular context. And it may be that some states really believe in expanding. Others believe in maintaining a balance. So you need to understand what the preferences are and where they come from. And also constructivism is important in making sense of how states understand other states. Questions about, you know, trust and so on and so forth. In the realist framework, there is no trust. You can never trust anyone in a jungle. You have to assume the default, which is the other side is out to get you, unless you get them first.
So it's a very pessimistic, as it were, view of the world.
It's a Hobbesian view, basically. Mm. And what you've got with constructivism is telling, you know, basically a suggestion that there are other things that may shape how you think about it. Again, there is a set of theories that are known as ideational theories, which is basically the set of ideas that inform states and obviously state leaders, has a very big import on how states behave. And therefore, you cannot explain international politics in antiquity or the Middle Ages with the same kind of logic that you would explain international politics today, for example.
Yeah, we'll get to the constructionist theory in a bit. Since you mentioned antiquity, a lot of people associate this kind of realist framework with the ancient Greek historian Thucydides and his political thought. Why is that? What do they find in Thucydides' analysis that they see or identify as a kind of realist account of the world?
Well, the same, I guess, that they find in Machiavelli, which is a discourse, a description of reality that is completely unadorned by any other assumptions than the, you know, pure competition for victory and survival. And of course, the fundamental piece that every IR scholar assigns to their students is the Melian discourse, in which the Athenians describe to the Melians what is going to happen if they do not capitulate. Mm. They're basically going to disappear. And this is given as an example of a non-moralizing, purely, I would say, very cold, but very exact description of the reality as it is. Of course, like in every text, you can find evidence of different kinds of theoretical frameworks. Thucydides, for example, has a very nice description of the Sicilian expedition of the Athenians, where he, in a sense, explains the Athenian disaster in Sicily through the combination of arrogant overreach. So he certainly tells us, he's constructivist in that respect, he tells us that there are certain leaders who, as a result of who they are, as a result of their makeup, their psychology, their fundamental personality, may develop preferences and goals that, in fact, are not really easy to implement or possible to implement. And so you get the hubris result. So in that respect, you can say Thucydides also has elements that depart from a purely rationalist perspective. Mm-hmm.
So, as you mentioned, this kind of realist framework is very focused on kind of the big picture structures. It doesn't really pay much attention to domestic politics, the beliefs and the preferences of political leaders, not even to political ideology, which, you know, a lot of us, I think, in the contemporary world think maybe that's all that matters somehow, that, you know, whether someone's left wing or right wing is what explains their behavior and their decisions. But this kind of realist theory seems to brush all that aside. And that's one of the reasons why you don't really buy this account of what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, and why this framework isn't really able to explain Russia's actions. Why do you think that this structural kind of picture is so limited, and why it fails to fully account?
It's certainly sort of very popular among the broader public because it is very simple and it resonates with our understanding of the jungle, so to speak. But it's not very popular within international relations. It's probably one of the least popular and certainly declining schools of thought. Mm. The much more popular one these days is the so-called institutionalist school of thought, in which institutions, including international institutions, mitigate this kind of creeping competition between states. And so, for example, trade is an institution that makes conflict less likely. Of course, you know, this is an example. Russia's invasion in the Ukraine is an example in which this theory actually doesn't work, because obviously Putin was willing to take pay a very steep price in terms of trade loss, given how much Russia is integrated in the modern sort of global trading world. Another insight of this kind of theory is one of the most interesting, I would say intriguing, empirical regularities that has been observed, which has been summarized as democratic peace theory. The observation is that democracies tend not to fight each other. Mm-hmm. They fight autocracies, autocracies fight democracies, and autocracies fight other autocracies, but it's very unlikely to find democracies fighting each other, which can only make sense if you accept that there is something inherent to sharing democratic institutions. And that cannot be explained by realism. There has to be something else doing the work. We don't really know. There is disagreement about why democratic peace theory holds, but empirically, it is a remarkable strong theory. And finally, we have another very striking observation, which is that since the end of the Second World War, we've got a decline of interstate war as a phenomenon. It's become extremely rare, very unusual. And that's why a lot of people, myself included, were struck by the fact that Russia chose to invade another country. Usually, states try to prevail in neighboring states by, in a sense, through proxy wars, by instigating or participating in a civil war or using other methods, but not by invading, and certainly not by trying to annex another country. And the reason why that's the case is because of nationalism. Since the 18th century, the development of a very powerful sense of national identity that corresponds to most states, the international system is made up of nation states, means that you cannot easily govern a state populated by people who do not see you as a legitimate leader. Mm-hmm. In a sense, alien rule has become abnormal. You can only sustain it with extreme repression in very specific, usually very limited places. For example, think about the West Bank in Israel. But it's very unlikely to think that Russia can subjugate and rule over a country of 40 million people, the great majority of whom do not want to be ruled by it. Finally, and the last point I want to make is the value of land, of territory, for, you know, the power of a state has declined very much and is declining very quickly because, you know, it's not so much what land can produce that contributes to the wealth or the power of a state, but other things like its economy, for example. And so for all those reasons, observing an interstate war, a land invasion, a conventional war between two states has become such an unusual thing to and needs to be explained perhaps through other ways. What I want to say is that even if we accept some of the basic premises of realist theory, it is very difficult to explain what happened in the Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, not only is it difficult to explain, but as you mentioned in your piece, one of the predictions of the chief kind of realist theorist, Mersheimer, it was that, you know, Russia would never invade Ukraine because it would just be crazy to do that under his sort of realist framework. And yet, you know, here we are.
It's very funny because if you read his interview in the New Yorker, he's being asked about that. And he says, well, I said, Ukraine is not going to conquer. Russia is not going to conquer Ukraine. And so he's trying to say that what we're seeing is not a war of conquest, which is really playing with the words. I mean, I don't think it's a very serious argument. He wants to say that, you know, Russia will get in, destroy everything and then get out. But then why do it from land? You can do it from the air. I mean, it's not very complicated to wreck a country from the outside. So that gives you a sense of how very often people who are very committed to a theory, irrespective of the empirical record, go to great lengths to, in a sense, sort of massage the empirical reality to make it fit into a theory. And in that respect, I would say the way international relations is organized around theoretical schools is very theological.
So absolutist, yeah. People really try and stick to their theoretical framework and make reality fit it. Much like Putin, according to you. So you argue in your piece, and you mentioned just now that one of the reasons that wars generally don't happen in the modern world like that is because people have this kind of national identity, which is very hard to, manage once you conquer a state and to be seen as the legitimate authority. And the other thing you mentioned is none of the kind of IR theorists for this reason and other reasons saw the war happening because they thought it would just be unsuccessful. But you argue in your article that if we actually paid attention to what Putin was saying about Ukraine, we might have been less surprised by this invasion. And you mentioned this essay that he had written in July of 2021, in which he essentially puts forward the argument that, you know, Ukraine isn't really a state. Not only that, it's not really a nation. And therefore, you know, there shouldn't really be much resistance to it being absorbed by Russia. So I guess I have a few questions about this. One is, as you mentioned in your piece, talk is cheap, and we often don't really take politicians' words very seriously because they're often just rhetoric and, you know, grandstanding and so on. And if we always believed what some of the political leaders said, then we'd think about the world in very different ways. So how are we able to distinguish, you know, when to take someone's word seriously and when not to?
We can't really tell, and very often you can find in a politician's record evidence for a variety of different kinds of reasonings. Putin also mentions a lot about NATO, especially as we move closer to the invasion. But in the period beforehand, and especially this July 2021 essay, there wasn't anything really about NATO. It's all about reestablishing the Russian world. In a sense, an area that's bigger than Russia itself, that's populated by peoples who are either related or fundamentally part of that Russian world, something that was destroyed by the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, that needs that to be reassembled. Now, one could argue that given the NATO argument, which is a realist argument that's well accepted, well understood internationally, both by domestic and international audiences, there was no reason for him to use this kind of language. which is completely anachronistic. So why did he use it? I cannot see the advantage. And if I cannot see the advantage, I have to, in a sense, surmise that probably it reflects a preference. So that would be an argument for why we should have taken that more seriously. And it sort of jibes with a number of other statements he's made. It jibes with this, you know, a set of descriptions about who he is as someone who was really shaken by the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was a KGB officer who saw his world crumble. And he's been quite successful to some extent in reestablishing the power of Russia, if not its economy. But maybe he's concerned about legacy, which is something that political leaders are often concerned, especially after many years in power. Or we have studies of authoritarian leaders that suggest that they become very isolated. They're sort of surrounded by sycophants who just tell them what they want to hear. They become bored with day-to-day politics. They start having grandiose, even megalomania kind of dreams. And a lot of them make mistakes produce overreach. So there are a number of other arguments that would be consistent with the idea that we should have taken seriously what he said.
So this takes us to this, brings us to this other kind of theoretical approach, the one you were hinting at earlier, constructivism, in which international relations theorists use, you know, leaders' belief systems or personal ambitions and personal preferences as kind of key to explaining the behavior of states. Is this the only fundamental difference between the two, kind of the realist and the constructivist school? Is it just sort of moving from a focus of agency being to the state as a whole and these kind of structural power relations to thinking more about individuals and individual agency and individual preferences? How do you account best for the kind of difference between the two different theoretical frameworks?
Constructivism can also be systemic, very much like realism is systemic, but systemic in a different way. For example, by pointing to norms. Very often we act the way we act, not because we can make a sort of true cost-benefit calculation, but because our cost-benefit calculations are embedded into normative constructs that we're not very conscious about what's acceptable and what's not, what is doable and what's not, things of that sort. Of course, the challenge with constructivism is establishing ex ante that certain norms exist rather than ex post. But certainly we know from studies of human behavior that humans very often are not very good at rational calculations. They assume a lot of things. They miscalculate in very predictable ways. There is all this work by David Kahneman, for example, and others suggesting all these kinds of shortcuts and heuristics that people use that are not necessarily consistent with the purely, crude rational understanding of the world. So constructivism is a sort of basket kind of theory about the kinds of things that people do that depart from what would be predicted by a very simple, very straightforward type of rational calculation.
I read in one of the links to your article, the one that explains a little bit about what constructivist theory is, that it's a product of the kind of post-Cold War era. And I guess it was a reaction to seeing the realist approach as maybe kind of having reached its explanatory limits and explaining what was going on in the world. For example, yeah, it talks about how, well, the Soviet Union, you know, didn't collapse merely because of kind of realist reasons, but also because of how individual actors sort of saw things and their beliefs. I was wondering whether, you know, this is also a kind of return to an old-fashioned account of history, the sort of so-called great men account, where we see individuals like, I don't know, Alexander the Great or Caesar or Constantine the Great, Stalin, and so on, as kind of the main motors of history? Or is this a kind of unfair characterization of it? Is it a bit more sophisticated than that?
It's much more sophisticated. And certainly I would say the example of Ukraine suggests that we should pay more attention to collective forces as well, to ideologies. I mentioned nationalism So nationalism doesn't really fit very well within realism, because in the realist paradigm, the state is able to do whatever it wants, irrespective of what the ideas are that most of its citizens have. But what we've observed and what explains often systemic change are waves of popular mobilization that are driven by very specific ideologies. In fact, you could say the very rise of the Soviet Union was linked with a communist revolution, which was a very specific set of ideas that has nothing to do with realism and informed very much the kinds of perceptions that people had. So if you are a constructivist, you want to understand how communism as a frame of thinking informed Soviet leaders, for example. So in this particular example, we have to make sense of the fact that the Ukrainians were, moving towards the West, very much like Russia itself socially has been moving towards the West. And they wanted to, enshrine this kind of movement in a set of institutional belongings and memberships, especially the European Union and secondarily NATO. And you could also argue that, that example of a growing and perhaps more successful democracy next to a country that's very similar in terms of language, in terms of shared history, was posing a threat to Putin. Having a successful democracy next to you is not a very good example. We know that that was, a key reason why East Germany collapsed. It was the example of West Germany next door that was, so powerful. So again, that gives you additional variables to include, which have to do with the expansion and germination and spread of particular ideologies, the role of collective actors, the role of institutions, ideological diffusion, how examples can be used to motivate people, the concerns of autocratic leaders about their ability to remain in power. One of the, I think, fundamental attributes of democracy, which differentiates it from autocracy, is that even though politicians in democratic states are equally obsessed about being in power, they've learned, for normative reasons, to accept that they can move away from power if they lose elections, for example. Whereas an autocratic leader cannot accept that. So that's part of their mental world. And so these are factors, I think, that we need to take into account. And on the one hand, they complicate the picture much more than the very neat picture of realism. But at the same time, they also allow us to make predictions about what is likely to happen. For example, one of my very easy predictions to make about what is going on right now is that as a result of the Russian invasion in the Ukraine, the Ukrainian national identity is going to be strengthened very much, because we know that when states are attacked, this is a factor that reinforces very much the national identity of their citizens. So we're likely to see eventually out of this invasion, a Ukrainian nation emerging that's much more powerful in the sense of internal cohesion than it was up to now.
So there's a quote in your article that I really like, in which you sort of, I guess, try and balance things a little bit by saying there are times when history is powered by people's desires rather than the logic of the international system. I was wondering whether in that quote you're also allowing for a role for the logic of the international system and in some ways the logic of, the realist framework. So is it possible to still think that, that old kind of very simplistic account of states just fighting for power and influence and, nothing else really matters still plays a role in how we understand events, even if sometimes that's not the main thing explaining what's happening and it's more, in this case, people's beliefs and desires and ideologies that are driving the events?
Absolutely. I think we shouldn't go to the other extreme and assume that you can get away from some of the fundamentals of a system that's, again, you know, the fact that there is no central ruler in the world means you're going to have this kind of situation of anarchy. You can never completely ignore it. So my argument would be that, you know, sometimes you have these kinds of disruptions that are brought by domestic forces. Think about the French Revolution completely upending the system that existed, the system of states that existed in Europe at the end of the 19th century. And then after everything is said and done, you've got Napoleon emerging. So in a sense, a system of, again, balancing and rebalancing that reasserts itself, but it does so in a context that's, you know, ideologically and in terms of, you know, state boundaries, et cetera, very different from what it was before. So it's a matter of interaction of various forces. And the logic plays out again, but it plays with different actors under different conditions, et cetera. One of the things that the French Revolution brings to the fore and becomes the main weapon that Napoleon uses against its opponents is precisely nationalism. Is the fact that he can mobilize French people to fight as opposed to having to raise mercenary armies. He couldn't have done that without the French Revolution creating this kind of identity that allowed ordinary French people to join in and fight and the size of the armies increasing and giving him a very, very definite strategic advantage and then forcing all the other states, in a sense, to move in that nationalist direction that dynastic kingdoms and empires of the time were rejecting.
So I was wondering, to sort of connect it a little bit to philosophy as well, I mean, we've talked about realism and constructivism, and they are these kind of big, if you like, philosophies of international relations. But, you know, today's international relations are tomorrow's history, and a lot of us are very aware of the fact that what we are witnessing today is probably, you know, going to go down in the history books as quite a significant chapter. And I was wondering what the relationship might be between these two different approaches, the realist approach and the constructivist approach, with a different distinction that we usually talk about when we talk about history and the philosophy of history, which is this different approach between seeing history as driven by necessity and by structural forces. And these are usually attributed to, you know, Hegel and Marx, who have, you know, very different accounts about what the necessary structures moving history are. But they both thought there's something inevitable about the way that history develops. You know, Marx almost talked about it in terms of there being, you know, laws of history like there are laws of nature. And then there's this other approach, which kind of sees history not as driven by necessity and laws, but driven by contingency, driven by events that happen accidentally, by just people being in the right or the wrong places at the at a particular timing, different sorts of factors coming together to produce a result that otherwise wouldn't have been produced. So do you think there's a kind of relationship here between these two different frameworks of thinking about history and how people have been thinking about international relations, or are those sort of separate issues?
Not necessarily. I would say all of those theories, in a sense, try to make sense of reality. And they try to discover what the underlying patterns may be. Of course, realism being simpler, more straightforward, is closer to this kind of, you know, idea of history as moving along a very deterministic path. Now, that raises a more general question, which is the question of social science. The idea of social science is to discover the deeper laws of history, which raises the question then, why are we unable to do so? Because if history is moving along a predetermined path, we should be able to observe it. After all, we've discovered things that are much more invisible than the path of history, such as the force of gravity, for example, other, you know, scientific discoveries. We understand how, you know, planets that are like billions of miles away from the Earth actually operate. So what is it about history and the forces of history that we cannot identify? And the answer has to be then that history doesn't follow such an easily identifiable path, at least one that allows us to make the kinds of predictions that we would dream of making. And therefore, my point would be that we're closer to the very contingent, very unpredictable dimension. But having said that, then, you know, that would defeat any attempt to studying the past. Why study the past if it's impossible to say anything? So eventually I sort of converge to this, you know, famous Marx statement that men make history, but not however they want it. They make it under conditions that can perhaps be identified. And this interaction is still opens up a tremendous amount of possibilities, but it excludes some possibilities. There are possibilities that are outside the realm of what can be implemented. And therefore, you know, we have the ability to simplify the world and you know, to make sense of it. And yet, even after simplifying the world, there is a whole range of possibilities. It's very interesting that every time something is over, everyone comes up and says that they understood and they knew about it, which raises the question, so why didn't they predict it beforehand? I mean, right now, nobody can really tell us what is going to be the end game of that, you know, invasion of the Ukraine. So I don't claim to have any predictive powers, but, you know, just for the sake of it, I'm going to give you my own at least, you know, informed expectation, which is that based on my understanding of how, you know, these kinds of wars work on the ground, given that nationalism is powerful and occupation is extremely difficult to achieve, if not completely impossible, my immediate sort of expectation would be that, you know, Russia can win militarily in Ukraine, but it cannot really subjugate Ukraine in a durable way, especially having caused its national identity to become stronger. And so then if we push that kind of line of reasoning a little bit more, we, you know, have to accept that no matter how Putin sort of massages the outcome, it's not going to be a very pleasant outcome for him. He's caused a lot of damage for not very much gain. Certainly not his maximalist idea about incorporating Ukraine into the Russian world. So no matter how he massages reality, he's ultimately going to be seen as a failure. He's going to have lost a lot of political capital, which is very likely to increase dissension within his regime, and with dissension, the likelihood of him being removed increases. So even though we cannot make any predictions about it, I would argue that, in a sense, we are closer to Thucydides' description of hubris than of realism here, of a leader who, because of arrogance, overreached, and as a result brought the downfall to himself. That would be my Thucydidean, non-realist expectation about the future.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. I'll ask you a final question, which is whether you have a book that you'd recommend to listeners as a kind of introduction to thinking about international relations and their different frameworks, or thinking about history and different ways about approaching that. Tools that could maybe help people try and think of what's happening in Russia and Ukraine today through a number of different, you know, interpretations and lenses.
There isn't, I don't think there's a book I've read, and I'm not someone who does international relations. My field within political science is called comparative politics. Even though what I do sort of exceeds its boundaries, it's really between international relations and comparative politics. I've never really read that much in international relations. So I don't really have this sort of go-to book to recommend for it. But, you know, one book that very often people recommend when it comes to understanding the sort of most straightforward arguments of realism is sort of a Bible of modern realism is a book by an American political scientist, Kenneth Waltz, which came out in 1959 called Man, the State, and War. And that, in a sense, is a summary of the basic tenets of realist theory.
Towards the end of your piece, you talk about how, given that it was just 200 years from the celebration of Greece's War of Independence against the Ottoman Empire, you were reading Mark Mazower's new book on that period of history, and it struck a chord that you could find some parallels perhaps between how the outcome of that war ended up and what might be the case with Russia and Ukraine. I don't know if you wanted to say a few words about that.
I was reminded very much of the Greek War of Independence that erupted in 1821, because on the one hand, the Greeks at the time had also this, you know, this very strong yearning to escape from the Ottoman embrace and join the West, which they saw as the an objective that would make them partake in progress and prosperity, in civilization, as they were calling it at the time. And of course, their insurrection was a very big threat for the Ottoman Empire, because it gave an example to every other people, and indeed, eventually, others imitated the Greeks. But it also upended and threatened the balance of power that had been established in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars by the Concert of Vienna and the Concert of Europe, which prevented, in a sense, was meant to prevent any change in boundaries that would cause turmoil and wars in the European system. So based on purely realist predictions, the Greek insurrection should have not produced any outcome, should have been forgotten in history. Instead, it was successful and really very influential. And I was reminded of all that by reading a recent book by the American historian Mark Mazower called The Greek Revolution, which in a sense is how that revolution changed Europe. Didn't just change Greece, it really changed the international system of the time.
Stathis Kalivas, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. To find out more about The Philosopher and order a copy of the latest issue, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. You can also find out about some upcoming online events. If you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Philosopher in the News, please consider leaving us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. The link is in the show notes. I always enjoy hearing feedback from listeners, and it's also the main way that others can find the podcast. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.